Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, now we continue with the study of the Majjhima Nikaya. And the last time, quite a long time ago, I finished a sutta that dealt with the 10 powers and the 4 grounds of self-confidence of the Buddha. So in a way that took us all the way through, we went through suttas dealing with all of the different stages of realization up to the qualities of the Buddha. Now in the next section, we'll be dealing with some suttas that discuss not doctrinal points, but they deal with different aspects about life in the Buddhist monastic order, in the Sangha. Okay, and so the first one that I have in this category, it's called the Chula Gosinga Sutta. This is the shorter discourse in Gosinga. Gosinga was the name of a forest. Okay, so when the sutta opens, the Buddha is living at a place called Nadika. And on this occasion, now the sutta is going to focus upon the lifestyle of 3 monks named Anuruddha, Nandiya, and Kimbila. Of these 3, the best known monk is Venerable Anuruddha. He was from the Shakyan family, so he must have been a cousin of the Buddha. The other 2 monks, I don't know very much about their background, but they seem to have been close friends with Anuruddha, and in several suttas we find them living together. Okay, so on this occasion, these 3 monks are living in a place called the Gosinga Solitary Woods. The word Gosinga means the horn of a cow, a cow's horn. And the commentary explains that in this woods, there was a tree that had branches that came up resembling the horns of a cow. And so for that reason, maybe it was a rather peculiar tree, so they used the word cow's horn to refer to the whole forest. And it's a forest of sala trees. The sala tree has a special significance in Buddhism because it was between 2 sala trees that the Buddha passed away in Kusinara. Okay, but this sutta takes place when the Buddha is still alive and in good health. And so one day, the Buddha, after rising from meditation, he went to this Gosinga solitary woods. And it seems that this woods was a protected forest, because it has a guardian or a park keeper. And so when the park keeper sees the Buddha coming, he doesn't know that this is the Buddha. And so he tells him, do not enter this park. There are 3 young men here who are seeking their own good. That's the kind of expression that means that they're meditating very earnestly. Okay, but it seems that the monks must have heard the parkeeper speaking. It must have been very quiet. And perhaps there was some exchange or discussion between the Buddha and the parkeeper, and Anuruddha might have heard the Buddha's voice and recognized the voice. And so he realized that the Buddha had come to see them. And so Anuruddha tells the parkeeper not to prohibit the Buddha from entering. And he says that this is our teacher who's come. Okay, so then Anuruddha informs the other monks, and then all three of them go out to meet the Buddha in the polite way. One takes his bowl and robe, extra robe. Then when he arrives, one prepares a seat and another sets out water for washing the feet. And then they pay respects to the Buddha and they sit down on one side. Okay, then the Buddha asks, these are like standard questions or a standard way of opening a conversation. He says, I hope you're well, I hope you're keeping in good health. And I hope you're not having any trouble getting alms food. And Anuruddha says that we're keeping well and not having any trouble getting alms food. Then the Buddha says, I hope that you are all living in concord with mutual appreciation without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. This is a stock expression that comes in the suttas to describe a situation where monks are living together harmoniously. It's contrasted with another situation that one finds, for example, I think in Sutta number 128. Yeah, at the beginning of Sutta number 128 on page 1008. This is describing the monks at Kosambi. Kosambi was an important city in northern India where the Buddha had a monastery. And that monastery in Kosambi became the site for a big conflict that took place in the Buddha Sangha that almost divided the whole Sangha. It started through a quarrel or dispute that took place between two monks, and then each monk had his own group of friends and followers, and so the friends and followers of each monk sided with them. Then they drew more and more of the other monks into this conflict between them. And then they had their own lay disciples, lay followers, and they drew the lay people into this conflict until the whole Sangha at Kosambi and all of the lay people in Kosambi were all involved in this dispute. The Buddha came several times to try to settle that conflict. And the monks who were fighting said, Master, you mind your own business. We're going to fight it out until one side triumphs over the other. And do you know what the whole conflict started from? You see, in ancient India, they don't have or didn't have toilet bowls, flush toilet bowls, the way we have now. And so when one goes to the toilet, they didn't have toilet paper either. This is still done in India, but one uses water, keeps water in a kind of bowl or container to wash oneself after relieving oneself, then according to the rule of the Vinaya, after one uses the water from the container, from the bowl, one has to fill it up again, or else one just turns it over and leaves it empty. But the usual practice is to fill it up again, so the next person who uses the latrine will have a full bowl of water. Well, one monk relieved himself and used half of the water in the bowl and didn't fill it up. Then another monk criticized him for that, and he thought he was right. And so, in this way, from this disagreement between the two monks over whether it's obligatory to fill the bowl after relieving oneself in the latrine, this whole quarrel that took place that almost divided the whole Buddhist monastic order. Okay, so here we have the standard description of how monks behave when they're in a conflict. In paragraph 2, the monks at Kosambi had taken to quarreling and brawling, and they were deep in disputes, stabbing each other with, the Pali expression means, with the swords or daggers of their mouths. That is, when people are speaking to each other angrily, then their words become like daggers or knives that can pierce the heart of another person and cause a lot of pain and misery. So if you ever get into a quarrel with somebody and you start speaking angrily to that person, remember this expression, stabbing the other person with the knife or dagger of one's mouth, the dagger of one's words. And then you consider whether it's nice to speak in that way. Okay, but when monks are living together harmoniously, then the Buddha uses the expression that they're blending like milk and water. Because if you take milk and put it in with water, or put water into milk, the two blend together so that one can't distinguish what is the water, what is the milk. Okay, then the Buddha, the monks reply to the Buddha that they are living in concord and harmony without disputing, that they're blending like milk and water. And so then the Buddha asks the monks how they're able to do this. And then they all say that they can live in this way because they rejoice at the fact that they have such good companions. And this is a very useful point of advice, because if you have good friends who are following the same spiritual path that you are, sometimes you might start looking for all of their minor faults, and everybody has some faults. And then if you let your mind just become fixated on their faults and sort of completely obsessed with their faults, then one starts feeling a lot of resentment towards the other people, and then one becomes inclined to engage in quarrels and disputes. But if you have good religious friends, good spiritual friends, even if they have some faults, shortcomings, instead of fixating on the faults and shortcomings, you think about their good qualities. And then you rejoice in their good qualities, and then you feel happiness and gratitude towards your spiritual friends. And then you can appreciate how valuable it is to have friends who are following the same Dhamma, studying in the same way, practicing in the same way. Okay, then Anuruddha goes on to explain further how these monks are able to establish harmony with one another. He says that I maintain or I engage in bodily acts of loving kindness towards those venerable ones, both openly and privately. Then I maintain verbal acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. And I maintain mental acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. So these are three ways, or three manifestations, one might say, of metta or loving kindness. One shouldn't think that loving kindness is just a meditation that you do. Then when you come out from the loving kindness meditation, you can behave in any way you want. But this loving kindness, if it's a real feeling of loving kindness, then it expresses itself in bodily acts of loving kindness, which can be both open or private. One engages in open bodily acts of loving kindness. For example, if say one of your friends has to lift something heavy, then you come over and you help them lift it to move something. Or if somebody, a friend, is ill, then you might go and get their food and bring them food, or go get a doctor, bring a doctor to see them, or get medicine and give them medicine. Again, if they have to travel someplace and they're not able to go on their own, then you might give them transportation. So these would be open bodily acts of loving kindness. But they're also, you might call, private or hidden bodily acts of loving kindness. For example, a junior monk, if he sees that the elder monk's room is dirty, when the older monk is away, he might sweep the room, clean up the room, set up the room, make it neat and tidy. So he doesn't have to advertise, I did this. So then when the older monk returns, he finds his room is nice, clean, tidy. You can sometimes bring a gift and put a gift on somebody's table. Give a gift to your friend, even without announcing that you're going to give it. Sometimes you might want to help them in secret ways without informing them. Okay, then one maintains verbal acts of loving kindness towards others, both openly and privately. One maintains the verbal acts of loving kindness towards others openly when one speaks courteously and politely to them. One speaks in a friendly way. One inquires after their health. And even if you're irritated with them for some reason, instead of speaking angrily, you first restrain yourself, and then you can speak about the problem that's troubling you patiently, calmly, gently. And then one maintains verbal acts of loving kindness towards others privately. Of course, you're not going to speak in soft, soothing ways to others when they're not present. So how does one set up verbal acts of loving kindness towards others privately? How does one do that? No. This is verbal acts, one has to be speaking.
Speak well about somebody else to another person.
Right, that's right, yeah. You know, very often people, even people who seem to be friends, but when the other person goes away, then one starts speaking to others about all of the faults that you've noticed in the person that you appear to be friends with. So this is a kind of two-sided friendship. When the person is present, you speak very politely, very kindly towards that person, very gently. When the person goes away, then you start tearing that person down behind their back. But if one is going to set up verbal acts of loving kindness privately towards another person, then one speaks praise of that person to others. One makes others aware of that person's good qualities. And even if one has to, for some reason, criticize that person to others, one doesn't do it with a malicious mind, but one does it because one sees that there's some purpose to be achieved. And so one tries to do so with loving kindness towards the other person, in the hope maybe by speaking with others about their faults, you can all get together and find some way to correct that person. Okay, and then one sets up mental acts of loving kindness towards that person, both openly and privately. I can't see how there could be a distinction, because mental acts or thoughts are always private to oneself. Maybe it means that when one is in the presence of that person, one has a mind of loving kindness towards them. And also if one is separated from that person, one still has the mind of loving kindness towards that person. Okay, then Anuruddha gives another explanation of how they're able to live together harmoniously. He says, "Why should I not set aside what I want to do, and I'll do what these others, these venerable ones, my friends, wish to do?" And then he says, "Then I set aside what I wish to do, and I do what these venerable ones wish to do." So we are different in body, but we are one in mind. You know, the Pali says, "Nana hiko no bante kaya, ekanchapana manye chitan." The word manye here suggests the sense, something like "it seems." So more exactly, it should be, even though we are different in body, but it is as if we were one in mind. That's the sense of manye, as if we were one in mind. It's not literally that they have one mind and three bodies, but because each of them is willing to give up what they individually want to do in order to harmonize with the others, then it's as if the result is that it is as if they were one in mind. But the secret to their success is In fact, actually, the Pali is quite interesting. The English is a little interpretive, the translation. It says, Soko ahang bante sakang chitang nikipit va imesang yeva ayasmantanang chitasa vasena vatami. Literally, this means, having put down my own mind, what's translated here as what I wish to do is literally having put down or set down my own mind, I act in accordance with the mind of these venerable ones. So the key in any way to establishing this harmony is that one doesn't insist on doing things the way one originally intends to do them. It means that one is able to compromise on one's own convictions about the best way to do things, even give up on one's own intended path in order to follow the wishes of the others. Since this is a small group of three, it would probably be easy for them to do this through open discussion. Each one expresses his own wish, the way he wants to do things, and then they find some way of doing the thing that will be agreeable to all three of them. When one has a large group, then it becomes very difficult to get people to work together in harmony. Because often you have, if you have 20 people, they each have their own way of wanting to do things. And sometimes even if of the 20 people, if 15 or 17 of them are flexible and adaptable, there'll often be 5 or sometimes even 3 people who become very insistent on getting things done their own way and aren't ready to compromise at all. Then just those 3 people in a group of 20 can create chaos and confusion in the whole group as people get aligned with different factions. When those people are insistent on doing things in their way, then they try to win others over their point of view. And then you get quarrels and conflicts. Okay, then the Buddha asks Anuruddha another question. He says, I hope that you all abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. Anuruddha says that they do. And then the Buddha asks, how do you abide thus? And I have to say that the reply that Anuruddha gives here doesn't really match the question very well. Because this question, abiding diligent, ardent, and resolute, appamatto atapi pahitatto, these words are when we meet them in the Pali texts, they're almost always used in relation to meditation practice. And so very often we see a kind of pattern in the suttas where when one monk wants to go off and to practice meditation on his own, he'll come to the Buddha and ask him to explain a method of meditation or to give him a teaching, Dhamma teaching, that will be of use to him so that he can go off into solitude in order to dwell diligent, ardent, and resolute. Is it amplifying? Okay, yeah, now it's stronger. And then in the same type of passage, after the monk gets the instructions from the Buddha, the text will go on to say that he went off to live in solitude, and then he dwelt alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute. And then in a short time, he achieved the supreme goal of the spiritual life, and he became another one of the arahants. Okay, so that's the way we usually find this formula. So here it seems a little strange, not the question, but the way the monks reply. And I understand from notes from my friend Venerable Anālayo, comparative studies between the Majjhima Nikaya and its counterparts in the Chinese agamas, that in that version we don't find this question used in relation to the description of the way the monks live. But that question comes only in relation to their meditation practices. So it's quite possible that originally the question here was the Buddha asking for further explanation of how the monks were able to live together in harmony. If we take that question, then the explanation given in paragraph 9 would make better sense. So here Anuruddha explains that whichever of us returns first from the village with the alms food, prepares the seats, sets out water for drinking and washing, and puts the refuse bucket in its place. That is, these monks are living in this woods, but there must have been a village within walking distance, or maybe several villages in different directions. And so they will set out on their alms round at the same time, but they will go in different directions or to different places. They don't all go together. The common practice now in many Buddhist countries is for monks to go together on alms round. But it seems here they're going in different directions, and so they might return at different times. And they will have, in the place where they're staying, an area where they take their meals, and here they will sit on the ground, not at tables, not in the forest, but they will probably have some kind of seats, maybe made out of straw. So the one who returns first will, this is a way of practicing loving kindness towards one's fellows, way of practicing loving kindness privately. So he comes back first, he doesn't wait till all of the others come back. But the first one who comes back will set up the seats, then they need water for drinking, and then for washing, because in India, in the Buddha's time, it's also now, the way one eats, especially from the alms bowl, is using one's hand, not with spoons and forks. So when one finishes eating, then one has to wash the hand. So one needs water for washing. And also when they return from the alms round, also sometimes their feet will be dirty if it's the rainy season, there might be puddles of water, muddy roads, and so they have to wash the feet. And then they also need the water for washing their bowls when they finish eating. And then they have a bucket if they have food left over that they can't finish, or things like banana peels, the rinds of fruits, the seeds of fruits, then they will throw that in the refuse bucket. Okay, that's what's done by the one who returns first. then the one who returns last will eat any food that's left over. So it could be that somebody returns rather late, and so if the others have leftover food, they will put out their food for the person who comes last to take. And then if he doesn't want the food, or if he has any leftover food of his own, he will discard it, and also the material that's collected in the refuse bucket, he'll discard in a place where there's no greenery, no green grass growing, or he'll drop it into water where there is no life. Though actually in all water there's life. But he'll put it into water where it won't pollute or defile the water in any way. Okay, then he puts away the last one to finish the meal. Will take the responsibility for cleaning up, though it's also possible the others will stay to help him. But if they don't, then he will put away the seats. He'll discard any leftover drinking and washing water and put away the vessels that were holding the drinking and washing water. And he'll also put away the refuse bucket. And then he'll sweep out the refectory. Okay, then if he notices that any of the pots for water, where they store the water for drinking or washing or for the latrine, are low or empty, then he will refill them. They'll have a big storage area where they store water. So he'll take the water from the storage container and fill the vessels that are hold the water for drinking and washing. Then if he has to move something that's too heavy for him, then he will call the others by a signal of the hand, and then they will join hands together and move it. But he says, we do not break out into speech. And so they, for 4 days out of every 5 days, they maintain silence. But then he says, every day, every 5 days, we sit together all night discussing the Dhamma. Though the Chinese version has a variation on this. It says, every 5 days, we sit together all night discussing the Dhamma, or we sit together in noble silence. So there's a difference of emphasis there. Okay, so then he says, this is how we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. Okay, now the Buddha asks him, while you dwell thus diligent, ardent, and resolute, have you attained any superhuman states, any distinction of knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, a comfortable abiding? Here we have an important expression. Uttari manusa dhamma alamariya jnana dasana viseso. This is a general expression that covers all the higher stages of meditation, both in samadhi as well as in insight and wisdom. Manusa means human being, and Uttari means higher. So this is Uttari Manusa Dhamma. It's a state that's higher than the ordinary human level. The states, good states of the human level would be the observance of ethics or morality. But what lies beyond the ordinary human level is the development of higher attainments in meditation. And then to this term, Uttari Manusa Dhamma, is added Alam Arya Jnana Dasana Viseso. This means some distinction or excellence in knowledge and vision, some superior wisdom, which is characteristic of the Aryans, the noble persons. And then Anuruddha answers that they do attain some superhuman state, some distinction and knowledge worthy of the noble ones. And it's also called a comfortable abiding or a dwelling at ease, because the mind becomes very happy, peaceful. So Anuruddha answers that whenever we want quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, we enter and abide in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought with rapture born of seclusion. And then he says that is a superhuman state, a distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, a comfortable abiding, which we have attained while we are dwelling diligent, ardent, and resolute. Then the Buddha expresses his appreciation for this, and then he asks whether they've attained any other superhuman state. And then Anuruddha says that they have, and then he goes on saying that they've attained the second jhana, then the third jhana, the fourth jhana. Each of these has its standard expression. Okay, then the Buddha in paragraph 14 expresses his appreciation of this and then asks whether they've attained any other higher state. Of course, the Buddha probably already knows what they've attained, but the Buddha is asking these questions just to give them an opportunity to make a statement. So then Anuruddha says that they have. Then he says that we've all attained the base of infinite space, and he uses the standard formula there. Then the questioning goes on, have you attained any other state beyond that? Then Anuruddha says that we've gone beyond the base of infinite space, we attained the base of infinite consciousness, then again the base of nothingness, then the base of neither perception nor non-perception. So in other words, Anuruddha is saying that they all have attained the four jhanas and the four arupa samapattis, the four formless attainments. Then the Buddha asks, he's still not satisfied with their answers, so he asks, is there any other superhuman state and so on that you've attained? Then Anuruddha says, there is, and he says, whenever we want, by completely surmounting the base of neither perception nor non-perception, we enter and dwell in the cessation of perception and feeling. This is called Sanya Vedayita Nirodha. Okay, to attain Sanya Vedayita Nirodha, the cessation of perception and feeling, This is a meditative state in which all perception and all feeling ceases. And this meditative state, it said, in order to attain it, one first has to have mastered the four jhanas and the four formless attainments. And one has to be at least an anagami, a non-returner. Only non-returners and arhants can achieve the cessation of perception and feeling. And according to the explanations given in the commentaries, to achieve this state, what one does is enter the first jhana, then one emerges from it, and one contemplates it with insight as impermanent, suffering, and non-self. Then one enters the second jhana and contemplates it also as impermanent, suffering, dukkha, and non-self. So in that way one is applying insight wisdom to each of the meditative attainments. So one goes through the second jhana, then one goes into the third jhana, comes out, contemplates it with insight. One goes into the fourth jhana, comes out, contemplates it with insight. Then one goes into the base of infinite space, comes out, contemplates it with insight, impermanent, suffering, non-self. Then one goes into the base of infinite consciousness, comes out, contemplates with insight, base of nothingness, comes out, contemplates it as impermanent, suffering, non-self. Then, before going into the fourth formless attainment, the base of neither perception nor non-perception, one makes a mental determination that one is going to enter the cessation of perception and feeling. And one makes the determination how long one is going to spend in the cessation of perception and feeling, whether an hour, a few hours, even a few days. It said that one could be in that state for up to 7 days. Then one has to make a few other preliminary observations and reflections. And then one goes into the fourth formless attainment, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And then from the base of neither perception nor non-perception, after being in there for a few turns, a few runs of consciousness, then one enters sanyavedayata nirodha. One enters the cessation of perception and feeling. And then one remains in that state for the duration of time that one has predetermined. And so here Anuruddha is declaring that we have all developed the ability to enter into the cessation of perception and feeling. And then he says, in addition to this, our taints, that is our asavas, the primordial defilements of the mind, are destroyed by seeing with wisdom. That is, they've gained the insight wisdom sufficient to destroy all the defilements. That means they've all become liberated arhants. And he says, this is another superhuman state of distinction and knowledge and vision, worthy of the noble ones, a comfortable abiding, which we have attained by surmounting the preceding state, by making that state subside. And then he adds, we do not see any other comfortable abiding higher or more sublime than this one. That is then the attainment of arhatship, the destruction of the defilements. Then the Buddha congratulates him again and says, good, good. And he confirms there is no other comfortable abiding higher or more sublime than that one. Then the Buddha continues to speak to them, instructing them, giving them further instructions. Though if they're arhants, it doesn't seem there should be any reason for them to need it. But this is just the stock formulation that's given here. Then the Buddha gets up from his seat and leaves. Now comes an interesting paragraph. When the Buddha leaves, they accompany him a little way, then they come back. And then the other two monks, Nandiya and Kimbila, say to Venerable Anuruddha, have we ever reported to you that we have attained those abidings and attainments which you were ascribing to us when you were speaking to the Buddha? You see, even though they had achieved all of those attainments, but they were very modest and they never revealed this to even to their close friends. But each one just kept these realizations and these attainments to himself. And the Venerable Anuruddha then says, you never reported this to me. You never reported to me that you have attained these dwellings, that's the jhanas and the formless attainments, and these attainments. Yet, by using my own mind to fathom your minds, I know that you have attained these attainments. See, Venerable Anuruddha was one who had achieved excellence in the use of psychic powers, psychic facilities. His specialization was the divine eye, that is, the eye that one can use to observe planes of existence beyond the human plane, or to see world systems outside of our world system. That was the specialization of Anuruddha. But he also had the ability to read the minds of others. And so he used this ability to find out what his friends had attained. And so this was one way that he knew that the two other monks had reached all of these attainments. And also, Venerable Anuruddha, we see in a number of suttas that he has regular contact with deities, with the devas. And so the devas, the deities, informed him that his friends had achieved all of these meditative attainments. And so Anuruddha was able to speak about this, not only about his own attainments, but about his friends' attainments when they were speaking with the Buddha. Okay, then after the Buddha left, a certain spirit, the spirit is, we call a yaka, or yaksha, Sanskrit. Often the yakshas are depicted as fierce, terrible spirits, but sometimes these fierce spirits can be protectors of the Dhamma. And so the spirit, whose name was Diga Parajana, Diga means long, Parajana means other people, it's a rather strange name. Anyway, he went to the Buddha, and then he declares to the Buddha that it is a gain for the Vajjayans, a great gain for the Vajjayans, that the Tathagata, that the Buddha is dwelling in their country, and that these three clansmen, these three young monks are dwelling in their country. The Vajjayan country was someplace in northeast India. Its capital city was Vaisali, the city of Vaisali. Okay, then, when this yaksha, Diga Parajana, makes this exclamation to the Buddha, then the earth deities also repeat the same statement, that it's a gain for the Vajjayans that the Buddha and these three clansmen are dwelling in their country. Then that same call goes from the earth deities, it goes up to the heaven of the four great kings, then to the heaven of the Tavatingsa heaven, the heaven of the 33, then to the Yama deities, the Tusita heaven deities, the gods who delight in creating, that's the Nimana Ratti deities, then the gods who wield power over others' creations, Paranimita Vasavati deities. So we have these deities in one realm after another are all repeating the same exclamation. Then it goes up even beyond the deities who wield power over others' creations, and it goes up to the Brahma world, the gods of Brahma's retinue. And so it says that at that very instant, at that moment, this cry or this shout applauding the three monks was heard as far as the Brahma world. This is just like if you remember the first discourse of the Buddha, setting in motion the wheel of Dhamma. After the Buddha finishes the first discourse, then the deities from one level after another all exclaim, now the wheel of the Dhamma has been set in motion by the Blessed One in the deer park at Benares. Okay, so when this spirit, this yaksha Diga Parajana informs the Buddha of this, then the Buddha just confirms it and says, so it is. So it is. Then he makes another important statement. He says, if the clan, that's the family, from which these clansmen have gone forth from the home life into homelessness, should remember them with confident heart. That is, if they think about these three young men who have gone forth from their families to become monks, if they think about them with faith and devotion, then this will lead to the welfare and happiness of that clan for a long time. Because when one thinks about with faith and devotion of those who have reached higher spiritual attainments, then that creates a lot of merit in one's own mind. Then the Buddha says, not only the clan, but even if the people in the village from which they went forth, the town from which they went forth, the city, the country from which they went forth, if all of those people remember them with a confident heart, that would lead to their welfare and happiness for a long time. Then the Buddha speaks about the different social classes. If all the nobles, that's the Kshatriyas, remember them. if all of the Brahmins, if all of the Vaishyas or merchants, all the Shudras, the workers, remember them, that will lead to the welfare and happiness of the workers for a long time. Then finally he says, if the world with its gods, Maras and Brahmas, this generation with its ascetics and Brahmins, remember these three clansmen with confident heart, that would lead to the welfare and happiness of the world for a long time. It's a very strong statement. Then he says, see how these three clansmen, three young men, are practicing for the welfare and happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world, for the good welfare and happiness of gods and humans. Okay, and that is the discourse, the shorter discourse on in the Gosinga forest. If there's any questions, then please feel welcome to ask questions. It's not such a difficult sutta, so it doesn't really raise many questions. Okay.
Is this one of the few suttas that mention the ninth state, the state of cessation?
No. It is mentioned even in some other suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya. I think we had it when we took sutta number 77. It comes as the eighth of the eight liberations. Yeah, it's on page 639, it's mentioned. And then there's some discussion about this state of Nirodha Samapatti, cessation of perception and feeling, in two suttas, give a lot of attention to it. And interestingly, these are discussions between, in one sutta, it's a discussion between two monks, Sariputta and Mahakotita. In the other sutta, that's sutta number 43. And then the next sutta, sutta number 44, also discusses the cessation of perception and feeling. And this is a discussion between the nun, Dhammadina, and a lay devotee named Visakha, who, according to the commentary, was formerly her husband. Any further questions? Okay, yeah.
Well, I was wondering, even though they had attained these states, they didn't share their attainments with others, with their...
They didn't share with, according, that's what it says.
Is there a prohibition?
There's a prohibition in the Vinaya for a monk to announce having achieved one of these superior attainments to a person who's not ordained, to an unordained person. And if one deliberately makes a false claim to have achieved what's called an Uttari Manusa Dhamma, if it's a false claim, then it's a very serious offense. But since they're fellow monks, there would be no rule prohibiting them from speaking about it. But I think the point that's trying to be conveyed here is that they were so modest and humble that they didn't want even to announce to others that they had reached these attainments.
And wasn't it by example that that they were sending wasn't so much a verbal, they were going around, but their memory from their home, from their family, from the class, and everyone knowing about their attainment in itself was enough?
I think there's no mention here that the people from their family, the village, town, will know about their attainments. What the text just says that if the people from their family, village, town, and so on think about them or remember them with a confident heart. Confident means this having faith and devotion towards them or respect and veneration towards them. Then that will be for their benefit. Even it's assumed that the people from the town and village and family won't know about their attainments because they don't go about announcing to their to others that they've achieved such and such. But just if people know about the way they're living and they're impressed by their deportment, by their behavior and characters, then they will develop the quality called confidence, prasada, which it's like something like faith, but it doesn't have to do with believing anything, but it's more having a feeling of respect and veneration towards somebody who's leading a spiritual life. Okay, any further questions? Okay, next time we'll do the Mahagosinga Sutta. Okay, so let us end with the sharing of the merit.
Akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Pavagupadaya Avici hetato, etantare satakayupapanna.